You're listening to Midorihau's first broadcast on the 20th of January 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midorihau, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Zambians vote today in a presidential election, but what's at stake? And is Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's counter-terrorism strategy going to stumble as the Islamic State demands $200 million for the release of two of his countrymen? Tim Marshall and James Schneider join me in the studio to discuss these and the day's other main stories. We also hear from Monocle's Thomas Lewis why the West now seems slightly less keen on getting President Assad of Syria out of power.
As Syria continues to splinter and the ungoverned north of the country continues as a haven for Islamic State militants, President al-Assad, once the central problem in the upheaval in Syria, may be a key part of its solution.
Then we'll review the German news weeklies and get some music recommendations from journalist Pete Norton. That's all to come on Midorihau with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midorihau, but before all of that, here's Paul Osborne.
Five people from Chechnya have been arrested in the south of France on suspicion of planning an attack. Four were detained near Montpellier, the fifth 40 miles away in Béziers. Reports suggest that police have found caches of explosives. It's not clear if there is any connection to the attacks earlier this month in Paris. Four men appeared before a court in the French capital earlier, accused of supporting one of the gunmen behind the killing of 17 people. Japan's Prime Minister has condemned an apparent threat by Islamic State militants to kill two hostages from the country. Shinzo Abe was reacting to a video released online which purports to show the hostages, a Japanese journalist and a military contractor. The video demands $200 million for their release, the same amount pledged by Mr. Abe to countries fighting IS. He called the threat unforgivable and said Japan would not give in to terrorism, though Japan in the past has paid for the release of hostages. Meanwhile, the UN is condemning violence against civilians living in parts of Iraq and Syria under Islamic State control. A report details stonings and crucifixions after what the UN High Commission for Human Rights called questionable trials. Spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says new evidence highlights what she's called a reign of terror.
There are these courts, these so-called Sharia courts that are set up, and quite often immediately after the sentence is handed down, the people are executed in public. And this, the kinds of people who are executed are across the board. Some are executed for being disloyal to ISIL, some for refusing to pledge allegiance. Others, as I mentioned, there were these four doctors who were killed for refusing to treat ISIL fighters.
There are reports of violent clashes in the capital of Yemen and claims of a possible coup attempt there. Houthi fighters enter the presidential palace in Sana'a after clashing with security guards, and it's reported that they've now moved on to target the president's home. On Monday, Yemeni officials claimed there'd been an attempted coup by troops loyal to the former president, Ali Abdullah al-Saleh. Houthi militias have been in Sana'a since September last year. Indonesia's transport minister has offered a new explanation for the loss of an Air Asia passenger jet in the Java Sea last month. Ignatius Jonan says the plane climbed too fast, then stalled and crashed, killing 162 people. He has told a parliamentary hearing in Jakarta that the jet climbed at a speed of 6,000 feet per minute, three times the normal rate at which a commercial aircraft would fly. A preliminary report on the crash is due by the end of the month. The man who first discovered the Ebola virus is warning of a race against time to develop a properly tested vaccine. Work is continuing on a number of possible vaccines against the disease, but as the outbreak slows in West Africa, it's possible that scientists won't get a chance to conduct large-scale trials. Peter Pyatt, who's the director of London's School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, says that would make treating the next epidemic a little harder, but he also says there have been huge advances.
It's a race against time now. In order to find out whether a vaccine protects, the epidemic has to be active. But regardless of that, we will know whether it is really going to induce antibodies that are protective or they have side effects, so that even with a waning epidemic, we will have far more information and ready for the next epidemic.
The creators of a solar-powered plane have announced that it will start its round-the-world flight next month, as the pilots try to prove that long-distance flight is possible without fossil fuels. The plane weighs around as much as a family car, but has a wingspan equal to the largest passenger jets. It'll take off in late February and is due to complete its journey by July. During that time, it'll be in the air for around 25 days. Bertrand Piccard is one of the two pilots and is the project's co-founder.
The plan is to have solar impulse airplane taking off from Abu Dhabi, flying around the world through India, China, the Pacific, America, Europe and back to Abu Dhabi. Renewable energies and clean technologies can achieve impossible things, that we can bring solutions to climate change.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Way you London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Oplondo, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor with Sky News, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African Magazine. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who's vowed to save two Japanese hostages being held by Islamic State. The IS militant group has demanded $200 million in return for the hostages. In a video of the captives just released, an IS militant is also seen criticising Japan for pledging to aid countries fighting jihadists. Tim, we've seen a change in policy, foreign policy for the Japanese. They've been looking to ditch their pacifist constitution and to re-engage with the world. This doesn't look good for that policy, does it?
There's two. That's the backstory to this human story. I mean, obviously, the human story is the tragedy of these two men, and the chances of him getting them out and saving them are slim at best. The political aspect of it is exactly as you say. Abe, in both Abe economics and in foreign policy, is quite a revolutionary. And in foreign policy, he's the one who has a very liberal interpretation of the Japanese constitution. And so the Japanese defense forces have been turned effectively into a modern fighting military. And he's pushing them out into the world. Massive debate, especially from the left in Japanese politics, that no, we shouldn't be doing this. But that's where they're going. But there are prices to pay to play in the world. And so he's playing out in the world. On Saturday, he's in Egypt and says, I'm going to give $200 million in non-lethal aid and more aid for the whole region. Lo and behold, 2 days later, when he's in Israel, I don't think there's any coincidence about the timing, when he's in Israel, up comes this video saying, we've got these Japanese guys. If you want to play, so will we. And he is in such a trap now. He's rushed off back home to Japan. He's cut short his Middle East tour. And he's going to have to go into crisis mode. But it's difficult to know how he can get them out without coming up with $200 million, the same amount as he's giving in non-lethal aid, which also is not a coincidence. And I think it's a domestic problem for him. And it's a tragedy for the two men, probably.
And Tim, just before I bring in James, what's interesting is, as we said, it is non-lethal aid that he'd been offering these. He is offering support to countries fighting jihadis, but he's certainly not giving them arms. So he'd tried to play a very tentative game, but even that has kind of got him into trouble.
Yeah, he's playing a sophisticated game and they're playing a law of the jungle game. Because if he wants to give their enemies $200 million in non-lethal aid, they say that he is interfering he's become their enemy, and consequently the two Japanese guys that they've simply had there in their back pockets. I mean, they really are, they're human beings, but they're also pawns. And they've just been sitting there waiting, and they've got other people in other nations, and when other nations do X, they will produce Y, which is the video.
James, when you look at this situation, what's also intriguing is one of these gentlemen is a journalist who knew the dangers and knew that it was very risky to go and kind of went on his own. And the other gentleman, that some Japanese press are saying he may be some kind of fantasist who had kind of sent himself off as a military consultant. Do you think there's much that governments can do to control these situations? They do, as Tim say, follow a horrible, gruesome script, all of these IS videos. We know the outcome. It is almost inevitable, it feels. Do you think there's much that governments can do or they should do? Because they can't really pay a ransom in this situation, can they?
No, they can't pay a ransom. One, you can't give ISIS as much money as 200 million, but also there is the argument that the paying of ransoms funds the organisations. If you look at how Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula funded, a large portion of their funding comes from paying ransoms. And also it incentivises further kidnapping, which is why it's been more British or American kidnappees who are more likely to be killed, because they're less likely to have ransoms paid for them. If you kidnap someone who's French, you're far more likely to get a bounty out of it. Governments trying to stop fantasists or otherwise, or going to particular areas, I think they can issue guidelines, they can say don't go. But it's very difficult for governments, and they shouldn't, and they can't really, to say, you categorically cannot go to such and such an area. They can say that you will not get primary assistance if you go into such an area, but that's already the case. If they weren't aware of the risks, they should have been aware of the risks. And there's not that much more that the Japanese government, the world media, Western governments, or anybody else can make clear about the risks of going there.
Tim, you work for Sky. What would be Sky's policy if, a freelancer or even one of your own team said, I think I have an in? We have seen already, German reporters go and see on the ground what's happening with IS. Mm. Do you think at this time you would entertain a journalist wanting to go, or do you feel it is just really just too impossible once you see all these kidnappings?
The question is slightly above my pay grade. However, I will attempt to answer it partially, and that is that every time we've been, whether it's with government forces or with opposition forces, every single incident has been looked at very carefully by senior management and by safety teams. Recommendations have been given, advice has been given, and there have been times when people have said, management has said, we don't think the risk and the what you're going to get out of it. No, it's too much. But I have to say, every single example is looked at on an individual basis. So I can't really answer it more than that, because I don't have the specific example and the question. Sorry.
Well, there's a connected story which we're going to look at now, which is Syria. Now, the Obama administration officially still maintains that getting a lasting political situation in the country requires the exit of President Assad. However, it has gradually begun to look like the West wouldn't mind having Assad stay in power for a little bit longer, as it struggles to contain Islamic State's power in the region and in Europe too. Let's first trace President al-Assad's time in office so far with Monocle's Thomas Lewis.
Bashar al-Assad, the story goes, should never have become president. It was his brother, Basil, charismatic, handsome and the favourite of their father, Hafez, who was heir apparent to the al-Assad political dynasty. But in 1994, while driving through thick fog to the airport in Damascus, his car skidded from the motorway, killing him and leaving the succession of power in Syria and stability in the Middle East in question. Bashar, a shy and unassuming figure in the al-Assad family portrait, had been working as an optometrist at an eye hospital in London when news of his brother's death broke. He was ordered back to Syria, and the process of preparing him for power began. And on the 10th of June 2000, with the death of his father, Syria's hardline leader for almost 30 years, Bashar became Syria's head of state, the chief of its military and leader of Syria's ruling Ba'ath Party. In February 2011, what had been a relatively stable decade for Syria came to an abrupt end. As protests erupted across the Arab world, tens of thousands of Syrians took to the streets in a show of opposition to the ruling class, the likes of which the country had never seen before.
President Assad was defiant. But the protests continued, and few in the West doubted that it would be sooner rather than later that Assad would be forced from office. As the US and the West sought support for an air assault on Syria, Bashar al-Assad would soon emerge as the winner of one of the coldest stalemates between Russia and the West since the end of the Cold War, as the focus shifted from the open conflict in the country to its chemical weapons stockpile.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2013 is to be awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, for its extensive work for eliminating chemical weapons.
And as Syria lost its chemical arsenal, President Assad and his forces won significant ground in the bloody conflict to oust him from office, as the opposition fragmented and those with their own agenda jumped into the void. As Syria continues to splinter and the ungoverned north of the country continues as a haven for Islamic State militants, President al-Assad, once the central problem in the upheaval in Syria, may be a key part of its solution.
Tim, should he stay?
Not my choice, but it's clearly something I think the Western powers and some in the neighbourhood came to the conclusion that they came to probably as early as last September, especially after Mr. Obama's red line just sort of melted away. And the reason it melted away and the reason people have come to the conclusion, and it's now much more out in the open, is because they do fear après moi le déluge. You know, if he goes, then every bit of Syria implodes as opposed to just the various parts of it that have imploded. And you were kind enough to have me on in December and we were saying it's an open secret that they now do not want to topple him, that he remains as a warlord. They try and train the opposition forces to take on ISIS, not to take on Assad. They want him to take on ISIS now because that's considered the greater threat. And all those words that we heard over the past 3 or 4 years from all our foreign secretaries and secretaries of state saying he has no place, he cannot go, I think we should resurrect them and put them on the television, on the radio, and then say to people, you know, you said those words, will you say them again? Because they won't.
James, the West, their greatest concern is the overspill from Islamic State. You know, whether it's, you know, terrorism in Europe or whether it's killings here in Europe, they're scared of what will unfold in the communities here in Europe, as we have see so many people go there to fight as jihadis. Just in self-interest for the West, do you also feel that actually it would be a good time to bolster support for President Assad, for the regime there? We may not like what it did, but having a regime there that actually held on to the country, controlled it in a way, it would be better for us than what we have now.
No, I don't think that Assad, even with Western and Russian support, would A, defeat the threat of ISIS, and B, reduce the threat of, or all out defeat the threat of ISIS, and B, reduce the threat of terrorism in the countries that supported him. I don't think that if the US or the UK decided that they were tacitly in a major way going to support Assad and prop him up, that we wouldn't see terrorist threats blowing back from Syria. It's not as if there wouldn't be fighters going to go fight in Syria. I more think that, you know, sort of as Tim was saying, this isn't a choice. This isn't like, oh yes, we would now prefer Assad to be here. I think that all of Kerry and so forth, they all still think the same thing, that the long-term future of sustainable future stability in Syria requires Assad to go, but they just know that that's actually a very long way away. And in order to get to a position where he might be able to go in the future, you have to pretty much accept that he's part of any short-term now solution.
And the key to knowing that they've turned that corner is that nobody talks about Geneva 3. There was Geneva 1, Geneva 2, where they were. It was all about how to get him out of power, and they both failed. But nobody's trying to resurrect Geneva 3. The Americans are turning a blind eye to the Russian efforts now. There's going to be a Moscow conference, but half the opposition parties aren't even going to go. So I don't think anything's going to come out of Moscow. Basically, the situation is still unraveling, whilst at the same time some of the lines being fixed. fixed, and it has still got a year, 2 years, possibly more to go.
And when you say that, do you feel that the outcome will be, you know, the dispensing of President Assad and the return to Syria being a country, the defeat of IS? Because what seems strange when you look at the situation, it's great to have the Kurds doing battle from one direction, but the opposition to IS, the opposition to Assad, they can hold the old town, they can hold that, but they don't seem to be an aggressive force that is ever going to sweep through Damascus.
Except for the foreigners. And therein lies the potential key, which is that if Assad's obviously are against the foreign fighters and the ISIS types, the Free Syrian Army are also against ISIS, which is a lot of them whom are not Syrians. So if there could be some sort of awful Faustian pact under the table where the Syrians decide, all right, you know what, the real enemy? The two of them actually could have a tacit agreement against ISIS. Then they have to come together somehow as Syrians. And that means the different factions of the Christians, the Kurds, and the five or six other minorities. And they have to carve it out, and they have to have a ladder for the president to climb down, where he's still some sort of president, but the real power might lie elsewhere. I mean, but that, I think that is some way down the line after a lot more deaths and a lot more fighting.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Ajituck, James Schneider and Tim Marshall. When we return, we'll discuss the Zambian presidential elections and what Pope Francis thinks of family planning.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monaco editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finished paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
And welcome back to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:22. It's 7:22 in the morning in Auckland and 10:22 in Los Angeles. Still with me is James Schneider and Tim Marshall. Let's take a look now at Zambia, where presidential elections have been held today after the former leader Michael Sata's death last October. As the winner of the elections will only govern for 18 months, the time remaining of Sata's term, the fear is that the time will be wasted on preparing for another election in 2016. When the government should really be focusing on stabilising the nation's economy. James, this strange election process, you know, just for 18 months, then they have to run it all over again. And there are real issues facing Zambia. What's your view of the election process and the key issues that the candidates are facing?
Yes, it's a peculiar quirk of the Zambian political system where it's a presidential by-election just for the rest of the term, and the terms are set. Now, the reason why that is so that term limits are very clear. It's very clear when elections will take place, and nobody can mess around at the edges and, you know, extend their term of office for a year or a couple of years. So in one sense, it is positive, but it does mean that this election has been sort of slightly lackluster. Everyone knows that there's going to be another one next year. But still, the kind of the core issues are at stake, and the kind of dividing lines between the politicians are there, and they're mainly there on policy. And the sort of main policy difference between a sort of centre-left ruling patriotic front and against a sort of centre-right, liberal, more pro-business opposition party is mainly over what rate of tax the mining companies should be paying. And the government is trying to increase the mining royalties from 6% to 20%. And as the copper prices and other commodity prices are going downhill pretty steeply, and Zambia is very, very, you know, wedded to its copper exports, the opposition, Hichilema, the opposition leader, who's a very rich businessman, says, you know, we can't be putting this cost on business. So it's an election where the issues are clear. The politicians stand on either side, and whilst, you know, some mudslinging takes place, I mean, the real issue is that.
Could you just explain to us one of the really interesting quirks as well? The interim president is a white man, Guy Scott.
Yes, so the interim president, who was the vice president, is Guy Scott. He's a white Zambian, and he's not allowed to run in this election because neither of his parents, as it turns out, but you need both your parents to be born in the country according to the constitution so that you can run for president, which was a law that was brought in the constitution in the 90s, not to prevent white Zambians from running for office, but actually to prevent Kenneth Kaunda, the longtime independent president, from running for office again, from coming back after already ruling for 30 years because his mother was born in Malawi.
I think he has some 27 years in power. He certainly didn't know when it was time to leave the stage. Tim, what's also fascinating about Zambia is it's one of the countries which is most influenced by Chinese power in Africa. There have been problems there before where people have been slightly concerned about these communities which seem cut off from the rest of Africa. But an interesting case for the power of China in Africa as well?
Yes. It does impinge on the copper issue, which is an economic issue. But the Chinese are everywhere. I'm writing a book at the moment, actually, and it's about different regions of the world. And the more research I do, the more I realize just how the Chinese are everywhere. I mean, just everywhere in all corners of the world. I have to admit not knowing a great deal about Zambia, which just as well.
That's why you have James.
Exactly. But so on a very broad brush basis, because I am not in any way an expert on Zambian politics, but the little I know of it, I hope this isn't too patronizing, I just think how positive it is that here you have one of the more modern countries, modern political systems. You had already had a transfer of power. You might have another one now. Well, let's see what the result is. And it will be peaceful and most of the election will go ahead without too much corruption. I just think it's part of that success story, which you no longer have to look too hard to find in part of Africa. And also, Kenneth Kaunda is still alive at the age of 92. I mean, that's how little I knew. I was following Zambian politics. I just assumed he'd left us, but he's still there.
James, just quickly, but a benchmark for success then in Africa?
Yeah, I mean, Zambia's had several changes of power. If the opposition win, they'll be the fourth ruling party in less than 25 years. The economy has been growing pretty strongly, admittedly because of the commodity super cycle, but there has been lots of infrastructure investment. And broadly speaking, it's got pretty good positive politics, which are based on issues. It's got problems like lots of other countries. But yeah, I think it's a good benchmark for how things are improved dramatically.
Well, let's quickly finish with Pope Francis, who yesterday finished his tour of Asia. Last week, he raised eyebrows when, after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, he stated that it was wrong to provoke others by insulting their religion. Well, yesterday on his flight back to Rome, he made another widely publicised comment saying that good Catholics don't need to breed like rabbits. Instead, they should practice responsible parenting. I guess, Tim, we're always trying to look at Pope Francis through kind of slightly, liberal press eyes in a way. Do we like him? Do we not? So on the Charlie Hebdo thing, I think many papers felt he was a bit out of touch. But now he seems to be incredibly modern in what he's saying in trying to make Catholics rethink what they think about the number of children they should have.
Well, yeah, but he also went on to make absolutely sure that he did remind everybody that there are certain methods you can use which do not involve the pill and condoms and things like that in order to not have too many children. I don't think he's shifted Catholic theology on that one. And what was it he actually said? He's a great pope for headlines, which we like. He said, some people think that, excuse my expression here, that in order to be good Catholics, we have to be like rabbits. So he knew that the expression was going to get the headlines. And yet he went ahead and said it. I mean, I don't think there's been this isn't Vatican III.
James, important in an African context, when many communities do follow what their faith leaders say, to the letter, if he had come out and said, actually, it's fine, you can use contraceptions, that would have been a more important statement. But how do you think this will go down in Africa, this idea that actually maybe there is going to be some kind of change in thinking about the number of children you should have, etc.?
Yeah, it's obviously not as big a deal as saying, yeah, go ahead, contraceptives are fine. But it is broadly speaking positive, because it's come at the back of his trip to the Philippines, where he's basically been talking about climate change and the stress that humans place on the environment. And I think we can view him talking about, you know, population control and number of children we have in that same context. And I think, you know, sometimes we get a bit blind in the liberal media to, you know, how we should deal with Pope Francis, because he isn't liberal. He comes from a pro-poor theological perspective. And, you know, often we interpret that as being liberal. But I mean, actually, he's quite traditional. He takes actually a very traditional, but a traditional Pope pro-poor stance. And he falls within that kind of theological framework.
But oh, does he understand the soundbite? Well, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider and Tim Marshall, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to get some music recommendations from The Telegraph's Pete Norton, and we'll review the best German news weeklies. But before we get started on all of that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
Police in the south of France have arrested five people from Chechnya on suspicion of planning an attack. Four were detained near Montpellier and the fifth 40 miles away in Béziers. Reports suggest the police found a cache of explosives, but it's not clear if there's any connection to the attacks earlier this month in Paris. Japan's prime minister has condemned an apparent threat by Islamic State militants to kill two hostages from the country. Shinzo Abe was reacting to a video released online which purports to show the hostages, a Japanese journalist and a military contractor, and demands $200 million for their release. The reports of violent clashes in the capital of Yemen and claims of a possible coup. Houthi fighters have taken control of the presidential palace in Sana'a after clashing with security guards. It's reported they've now moved on to target the president's residence. And Indonesia's transport minister has offered a new explanation for the loss of the Air Asia passenger jet in the Java Sea last month. Ignatius Jonan says the plane climbed too fast, then stalled and crashed, killing 162 people. He said that the plane was climbing at a speed of 6,000 feet a minute, which is three times the normal fastest rate at which a commercial aircraft would fly. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:32. It's 16:32 in Sao Paulo. And it's time now to take a look at what's making the news in Germany. And joining me in the studio is Imke Hempel, Zeit Online's London correspondent. We're going to be looking at the German weeklies. And I think you want to start actually with Die Zeit, is that correct?
Yeah, I could do that. I actually wanted to start with Stern today.
Let's start with Stern.
Okay, because I'm really impressed this week by the Stern. Last time I slandered it because I felt they did everything wrong that he could do wrong. Today, this week, they're actually doing everything right that he can do. They have this, coming back to the great tradition of the Stern being a brilliant reportage magazine. So, obviously, they have the title about the attacks in the murders in Paris. Hate against fear is a title word. And they have a very long reportage about the events in Paris, the mood in Paris, and starting with beautiful picture. I mean, it's a little bit macabre to say beautiful in this context, but from a photographic point of view, it's brilliant pictures. It's actually quite horrific. They have pictures of the office right after the...
I wanted to ask you a question about this, about German sensibilities, because the page you've stopped on is a spread that's a picture taken inside the offices, and there is, you know, it's it's clearly, you can see the bodies on the floor, you can see the blood pouring across the floor. They have blanked out one of the people's faces, but I think it's, I didn't see this picture in any of the UK media. Do you think that's a surprising story to be run, or do you think that the Stern sensibility is to give people perhaps something a bit grittier?
And I think you're absolutely right to question that. I was shocked when I first saw these pictures in the Stern. But I think the thinking behind it really is to give something grittier, to actually show the brutal reality, not just to sweep over it. Because these pictures are not... This picture here, maybe it's slightly described, it's mostly of a view of the office, how it is destroyed, and you see an half body on the right-hand side and another half body and the, as you say, the face is blurred out. So it's not voyeuristic in that sense. It's not not showing bodies, but it is showing the destruction. And I think in that way, it really gives something grittier and brings home to the reader at home and how horrific the scene was.
Now, was it also interesting for, you know, I think when you live in the UK, yes, some newspapers and will try and do a summary at the weekend, but the number of pages that Stern has given to this is amazing. It's what's fascinating is, you know, this is a magazine that still sells hundreds of thousands of copies, that there is a market in Germany for people who really want to kind of get to grips with these stories.
Well, let's say, hopefully there's a market. I mean, all German news magazines are fighting the situation where they have a slump in sales. This week, actually, the quarterly sales figures were published, and again, every major newspaper and magazine lost in circulation. But I think it is the right decision, because what can a weekly magazine do? The story is, everyone who wants to know anything of detailed information already has it. So what you can do is really going into depth, giving you a picture, giving you a vast description that normally the brief and online media can't do, or daily newspapers can't do. And I think they went for it, and it was a good description and a good decision. And I think at least 100 of thousands of readers they certainly will have. There certainly will be people who come back to it. And it's not only a description of the situation in Paris. They have a very interesting interview with a lecturer from Islam who talks about Islam and how Islam should position itself.
No, it's a very impressive issue. Should we bring in one of the other weeklies? Where do you want to go, to Spiegel or Zeit?
Very briefly to the Zeit, and obviously their titles and story again is about these Paris stories. They have a very good leader by the editor-in-chief, Giovanni Di Lorenzo, who says we need to talk more about how people are radicalized in these Western countries, and that is actually a blind spot that we had. But he also reminded us that now everyone is solidaric, and we talked about how we and Je suis Charlie, and most papers actually in Germany reproduce the first edition of the new Charlie Hebdo.
Well, we saw the fire attack on one of the newspapers that published the picture. So it's been
actually before.
Yeah,
the fire attack was before, and it wasn't very detrimental. And he's actually rightly saying that it wasn't in Germany. It wasn't a big issue of courage to reproduce this picture, because there wasn't any serious thing.
Do you think there's a certain tenseness around the reporting at the moment? You know, we've seen the rise of the Pegida movement, these marches against Islam, especially in the east of the country. Are the papers putting some of that context into their reporting on what happened in Paris as well?
Absolutely. And Stern again has many pages about the Pegida movement, and that is actually precisely one of the focus of the Zeit leader as well, asking in what connection does it stand that people are now going on the streets and trying to basically capitalize on this mood. So this very, very much is a focus. And he also reminds us that actually when Salman Rushdie, and you remember his Satanic Verses, was when that was published, and the fatwa was put on him and threatened him with death, and I also threatened the publishers. The situation was slightly different. That again, in the beginning, there was a solidarity movement with German publishers, but then or no, actually the other way around, the publishers were afraid to publish this book, but then they were slandered by the media. But then when it came to the thing where media should reprint the book and had it pre-published, they shied away from it. So there's certainly always, so you basic questions, will we be solidaric in 2 weeks or 3 weeks' time? Same question put by the Stern.
We should probably bring in the other title. Is this Spiegel?
Yes, and Spiegel actually has a fascinating story not related to the Paris attacks or Pegida, but they publish again in one of the Snowden documents. And these Snowden documents shows that the NSA, the American Secret Service, which is part of the military, actually does cyber attacks on all over the world, on companies, on governments. And so they not only are very skillful in defending against cyber attacks from other countries, from China, North Korea probably, or wherever, but also sort of turn these attacks into these defenses into their own attacks. And they recently did it in Germany as well with an actually attacking the computer of a high-ranking official in Angela Merkel's office. And also, it is thought that the NSA is behind the Stuxnet. You remember that virus that attacked the
And there also was, as we know, we're listening into Angela Merkel's phone calls, or we're certainly monitoring the calls from her phone as well. And that caused a huge, you know, a huge amount of kind of tension between Germany and the US. When this story came out, has it been the same kind of concern about US involvement in Germany?
There was actually a funny thing that Angela Merkel tried to keep it quiet at the time, and it took her quite a while to come out of and to come out and actually protest against it. And I think it was just, there had been several news stories about how she was listened to and attacked by the American. And I think behind it was, among others, that Germany tries to be to cooperate more closely with the American Secret Service than they did so far. So they are in the outer circle so far, and they try to get more into the inner circle. So it's a funny thing.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but it kind of shows you why the German newsweeklies are so important. Really great reporting again from all concerned there. Thank you very much. That was Imke Henkel, who's Zeit Online's London correspondent. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll check in on the goings-on at two trade fairs, IMM Furniture Fair in Cologne and the SIH 2015 Watch Fair in Geneva. Stay tuned. Thank you.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. January is a busy season for trade fairs. The start of the new year marks a time to showcase new collections. Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, is currently at the IMM Cologne Furniture Fair, and our own Matt Alagaya is checking the pulse of the watch industry at the SIH 2015 Watch Fair in Geneva. Tom, let's start with you. We saw you last week in Milan at the fashion fair there. You've been at Pitti Uomo. It's a real kind of start of the year for you running around all these trade fairs. What happens in Cologne? What part of the furniture industry is showing there?
I know, I've lost it. I can't keep track now between what's a cardigan and what's a glam. Cologne is the last big event in the sort of the design calendar, basically. It's the last big one that happens before Salone in April. And what makes Cologne different is it's the fact that all sort of big things that the brands showed back in April in the last Salone, now they've kind of been put into production. prototypes have been tweaked. So Cologne is really the time when buyers come and see the finished product and make their orders. So it's much more of a kind of commercial event, and lots of business is done here. So it's a slightly different flavour to Milan, really.
And just tell us, is it furniture for your office? Is it furniture for your home, or is it a mix?
It's a mix, a bit of everything. You've got all the big German electronics and appliance companies here. You've got the big Italian furniture manufacturers. You've got some nice Scandinavian accessory makers and light fitters and things. So it's a real mix. But there's lots of good stuff to see, so.
Matt, we'll jump over to you in Geneva. You're at the SIH Watch Fair. Now, there's also Baselworld that happens. This is the smaller of the key Swiss watch fairs. We saw a huge rocketing in the value of the Swiss franc last week, and there was some feeling that many of the watch companies would be heading to SIH, slightly scared about what lies ahead. What's the mood for you at the fair?
Yeah, I mean, so there's been a kind of 20% jump in the Swiss franc over the last sort of 2 weeks that kind of put a bit of a dampener on it. But I have to say, all the brands who are here exhibiting are kind of, they seem pretty positive, and they're not letting it dampen their spirits at all. There are some really interesting things going on, a lot of new models that are very exciting. And no one seems to be too pessimistic about it.
Matt, just tell us something about the people who are showing there. So what are some of the brands that show at SIHH?
So you've got obviously the big Richemont brands, you've got Cartier, Jaeger LeCoultre, you've got Panerai, and then there's various others. There's 17 brands in all, so quite a big show.
And very high end, or is it about the latest jeweled watch strap, or is it about the inner workings of these watches? Are they selling it on the technology or on the fashion of the watch?
It's a bit of both, I guess. I mean, as the name suggests, it's called Salon International de l'Horlogerie, which means kind of high watchmaking. So there's a bit of both. There's obviously high fashion watches, but there are pieces here that are really being sold based on the mechanism, the movement inside.
Matt, just tell us, what are one or two of the highlights that you've seen?
Well, some of the real, really interesting things that are going on, there are a few brands are using meteorites, so actual materials that have been taken from rocks that have fallen from space and landed on Earth kind of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, one of which is Jaeger LeCoultre, which I mentioned earlier. They've used it on one of their watch faces. And it's a very interesting thing that they're doing.
So obviously, I guess that's when you're dealing with a luxury market, that the finding of very rare materials and their presentation, in a luxury format, that's part, I guess, of the backstory of why you would use such a material.
Completely. I mean, the people who are coming to these fairs, they're looking for that tiny thing that distinguishes a brand, distinguishes a watch, and they're all fantastically well made. They're all made in Switzerland, handcrafted, hand painted. And it's just the tiny, tiny details that people here are looking out for. And one of those is using something like meteorite on the watch face.
Tom, jumping back to you in Cologne, I guess what's been interesting for us here at Monocle over the last 8 years, we've kind of watched, as the office has begun to evolve over the past few years, you see more kind of offices where people have shared space, you have more offices and where, I guess people are kind of only working part of the day. Is that reflected, do you think, when you go around and you look at the stands for the more commercial furniture operators? Are they rethinking how we live our lives, both in the office and indeed at home? Or is it really just, okay, here's the latest desk, here's the latest lamp? Or do you feel there's kind of a bit of a backstory in how they present their furniture designs?
Yeah, I think that there's a sort of a bigger embrace of office furniture, which I've seen here, from the, designers that ordinarily just do sort of the more domestic market. Dring from Sweden, who make the very lovely shelving, they've recently gone into making workplaces. So they've gone into this, they've produced this new lovely desk which has the kind of traditional string wire slats behind it. And that's kind of, that was more of a contract piece of furniture. Vitra, obviously they've got a great heritage of office furniture. But the way Vitra have presented it this time is much more of sort of setting out in a home setting. So there's, bikes and things on their stand and lots of plants next to the office furniture. And I think it's this sort of tide of, the mixing of the two, the domestic market, the office market, and you can't really tell the difference between the two anymore, which is quite nice because that reflects how people work, whether it's in the office or back at home. There is a sort of the convergence of the two sectors of the market. You really see it, Cologne.
And finally, before I let you return to your various show halls, Tom, for you, are there any kind of other standouts from this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of the Scandinavian brands, which, you know, they'll do a little teaser here before Stockholm Furniture Fair in a couple of weeks, but Menu, a sort of fairly young Danish brand, and Tradition, another young Danish brand, both really amazing collections. The Vitra stand is particularly impressive because usually they show in a big white box with all their Eames pieces out, but they redesigned it because they've got a new head of homes, who's Mirko, who used to head up Artec. So they really kind of soften the blow of how they present it, and it's just kind of, yeah, the turning of the tide of how people sell furniture, I think.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Well, thank you guys for joining us. That was, of course, Tom Morris, who's our design editor, who is in Cologne at the IMM Furniture Fair, and Matt Alagaya, who's at the SIH 2015 Watch Fair in Geneva. And you're with Midori House. And we're going to finish today's programme with our daily arts review. And today we talk music, and joining me is the Daily Telegraph's music journalist, Pete Norton. We're going to start with Mystery by Boxed In. And I was just looking before we came on air, and I see that it's named after a Francis Bacon painting, or they share a name with a Francis Bacon painting.
Yes, yeah. I don't know how pointed that is, but yeah, I understand that as well.
And let's just hear a quick clip of it, and then I'll come back and quiz you.
Inspiration comes from the most unfamiliar places. I meet you, you are now me. Information sent, now lay down your heart of aces. What will be, will just be. Check a little later and I will go back to the place where we went slow. Giving it all so I can see.
Well, that's a very nice sound of Mystery by Boxed In. What do we need to know about Boxed In?
He's a young British musician, producer and songwriter who's been working for quite a while now. And he's worked with various bands as a production and co-writer credit. But he's just sort of branching out into doing his own solo stuff now. His name's Ollie Baston. And so his debut record, eponymously titled Boxed In, was released yesterday on Network. And I just think this is a fantastic pop song. He's a pianist, key player sort of by training, and the whole album has a kind of nice keyboard-led sort of ambience. But I just think that's a standout, solid gold pop song, that one. It's got everything. It's really nice production, catchy. It's got a lovely hook, and it's perfectly formed.
I had a quick peep here, his kind of CV, as it were, and it sounds like he's somebody who's kind of put in the time learning the trade almost, because he's kind of written songs and helped produce songs for the likes of Cock and Bull Kid. He's been a studio engineer. It sounds like he knows everything you need to know about doing the music yourself.
Yeah, and it really comes across in the album. It feels like a very mature work, very finely hewed. I know Dan Carey, who's a producer that I very much admire, has worked on the album as well with Ollie. And yeah, it's a treat. It's a real treat.
Brilliant. Well, that was Mystery by Boxed In. But next you're going to talk about a song that's been, well, a track that's been around for many, many years, because this is a reissue. It's Wayne Shorter and El Gaucho. And why have you picked this?
Well, I kind of wanted to switch it up a bit this week, and it's always, I mean, I'm a big jazz fan, and it's nice to be able to talk about jazz from the sort of golden era of 50s, 60s American jazz. And this Blue Note, who are the kind of the preeminent jazz label from the States, who are 75 years old last year, are now, they're doing every month, they're re-releasing five of their sort of best albums from their back catalogue on vinyl. Just as a nice way of kind of rejigging the interest in this great sort of wealth of material that they have. And this month, it's on the 27th of January, part of the cash they're releasing is this great Wayne Shorter album, Adam's Apple from 1966, which is one of the great jazz albums of that era, which features him, but also Herbie Hancock plays on there, and Joe Chambers and Reg Workman on bass. And it's just a great, great album, and it's nice to be able to sort of talk about it again.
Well, let's hear a track that you should be listening to really on vinyl.
Thank you.
And Pete, tell me, you read in, you know, even in Monocle about the revival or the continued persistence of vinyl. How big a thing do you think it really is? You know, are they issuing this because there's a big market for vinyl out there, or is it because they can charge more for collector's editions? How come vinyl is persisting? Because although I see it talked about, I still don't go around to many friends' houses who have a record player. I'm just about to hear that you do. But
I do. I mean, I think it is. It remains a niche. I don't think there's any argument that vinyl is overtaking any other format. But I think to be honest, it's been a reaction against the prevalence of digital technology has really made it. A lot of people feel like they've lost touch with the physicality of an album, and vinyl is the sort of obvious and ultimate way of connecting with that. Again, where you have to turn it over, and you're very much aware of the artwork in a much richer format than you ever got with CDs. And it's something that the digital format has yet to sort of nail that. How do you deliver a really nice package that someone is happy to own when it's just a file?
Because I often wonder, we obviously see it with the physical product that we put out for Monocle. We're magazine publishers, and we meet book publishers who, for example, we work with Gestalt in Berlin, super successful. That we go to bookshops around the world that have kind of not only kind of shaken off the competition that used to be around from the likes of Barnes and Noble, but are now kind of, you know, really thriving. The way that you get your coffee, you know, it's all about how it got to your cup. And it feels that this kind of vinyl thing is part of a constituency of people that are concerned about or passionate about how things are made, their stories, and the having, as you say, something more than a screen to kind of swipe their stories across, or just everything to be downloaded as an MP3 file.
Absolutely. And I think especially with this, it's very prescient with this particular batch of reissues from Blue Note, because these are obviously albums that went out only as vinyl in the first instance. So they're albums that were composed to have two sides and thought about in that way. So, you know, you're kind of re-engaging with the original source material, if you like, of these records. Which I think is great. I have nothing bad to say about it.
Good. Well, the final track is by Tom York, obviously formerly of Radiohead, and a gentleman who has a very long career. This is You Wouldn't Like Me When I'm Angry. Now, I imagine Mr. York, with his royalties these days, can do kind of what he likes. Does his music come across, you know, as an indulgence, or do you still think he kind of has that grittiness to kind of make a great record?
He's very prolific. I mean, he releases a lot of stuff for us solo now and via this website Bandcamp and other online formats. I mean, he's definitely been a forerunner of breaking away. And we were talking about the album as an LP, but he's very much part of a sort of movement, if you like, to think of different ways of releasing music. So he released an album late last year, on BitTorrent and Bundles, it's called. So it's sort of a peer-to-peer file transfer, but paid for. And it was released without any warning at all, just dropped, and then you could pay what you wanted to own it. And this track that we just heard was released on Boxing Day again without any warning, and just pay what you want.
And you like it?
I really do like that one. Yeah, I mean, I find some of his stuff is a bit obtuse or a bit, you know, it's sort of edgy and out there. And this one, it has a nice combination of electronic, you know, weird soundscape, but his voice floats over it in this beautiful way, and it feels like a, you know, you can hold on to it.
Well, Pete, three great recommendations as usual. That's Pete Norton from The Telegraph. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, James Schneider, and to also Tim Marshall. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Max Koshlik and by Alia Masood. And our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. Next, after the headlines, it's Section D, our design show, which is brought to you by Mr. Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily, and that's going to be with Emma Nelson and Romus Vielisis. And this show will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, and thank you very much for listening.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Where are you, London?
这是 Monaco 二十四。
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong.
Zurich,
London,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.